Hi, this is Glenn Wexler, and you're listening to Pantheon Podcast.
Pantheon Podcast presents from Hollywood, California, The Devil's Music with Pleasant Gaiman. You are invited to join the Hollywood princess as she explores her lifelong pursuits in the occult, sex, love, and that sinful rock and roll. Ladies and gentlemen, step into the dark parlor of Pleasant Gaiman as she brings you The Devil's Music.
Well, howdy there, sinners. This is Pleasant Gaiman, and you're listening to The Devil's Music Podcast. A Pantheon podcast. I'm a punk rock witch from Hollywood, California, with a lifelong passion for rock and roll and the occult. It all started when I was a preteen. In the 70s, I was one of the first punks in LA, and as a teenager, I worked at the Whiskey A Go-Go producing shows and made a Xerox fanzine called Lobotomy, which led to me writing for every major rock and roll publication you can think of. In the 80s and 90s, I fronted three bands. I'm a best-selling author with 8 books out and more on the way. For the past 30 years, I've toured around the globe to teach and perform belly dance and burlesque. You've probably seen me acting or dancing in music videos, feature films, and documentaries. Look for me in the new Go-Go's doc. To find out more about me, to purchase a book, or to make a tarot reading appointment, please go to my website, pleasantgaiman.com. I'm really excited to be part of the Pantheon Podcast's network of rock and roll shows. Everyone here tells stories about the music we love so hard, each with a different twist. Find all podcasts at pantheonpodcast.com or on Apple, Spotify, Stitcher, iHeartRadio.com, Pandora, anywhere you get your favorite podcast fix, baby. Today, my guest is Dana Gould. On the off chance that you don't know about him, he's a comedian, an actor, a voiceover artist, a writer, and we also share several unique fetishes. He's more fun than a barrel of monkeys. He's more fun than a carnival full of clowns. He's more fun than a ventriloquist with a lap full of dummies. Please welcome Dana Gould.
We are on.
Hi, Dana. How are you? When we did your podcast, we were very enthusiastically talking over each other the whole time. But I have to know you better all the time, and I'm so glad that you're doing this because now I can stalk you in real time instead of the opposite when I was on your podcast.
Yeah. It was one of those great things where you meet somebody and then you leave and you're like, how did I not know this person until just now?
That's exactly what I thought.
Yeah.
So we met backstage in 2020 whatever, because I'm having pandemic break. No, in 2019, back when things were normal.
The year 1 BC. Before COVID.
Oh yeah, BC. Oh my God, that's so scary. In the year of our Lord, the demon child.
The merry prankster.
Oh my God. It's a So we met backstage at a reading for More Fun in the New World, John Doe and Tom DeSavio's book. And at first, I think I didn't realize that you were being the MC that night, and I thought you were just like hanging out backstage like a cool celebrity should.
Or like a creep.
Yeah, I knew you were going to start stalking me because I had every intention of stalking you.
Yeah, no, I was very, I leapt at that opportunity to do that night. I didn't know any of those people.
Oh, really? So no. How did that happen?
Yeah, I've since become really good friends with DeSavio. But mm-hmm. I know Danny Bland, who, if you know.
Oh, Danny, I love him.
Yeah.
And Danny, my God, I have six stories about him, but I will spare that. Go ahead.
Yeah, those are the only stories about him. yeah, he's truly amazing. And for those of you who don't know Danny, he's by and large, he's a tour manager, but he works with Dave Alvin and the Blasters and he goes way back. And he wrote a book called In Case We Die, which was his story of being in rehab for heroin. And I read a part of the audiobook. He just reached out to me online, said, I'm a fan, would you like to do this? And we met and became very good friends. And I'm, you know, a crazy fan of the, you know, the LA scene from that time. I was literally at Largo doing a show, a comedy show, and they were looking for someone to moderate that evening, the author's night for More Fun in the New World. Whoever was going to do it dropped out, and literally it was one of those things where Flanagan like turned his head, saw me, and said to Tom, what about, do you know Dana Gould? And I don't think they knew who I was. So I said, like, I'm a friend of Danny Bland's. And I think Danny said, yeah, he's okay. He'll do a good job. And so that's how I met everybody. I was very, very, very nervous because I was like on stage with people that I consider heroes of mine. And so I was trying to I was trying really hard to be cool. And I was very glad that it was the version of me now and not the version of me 20 years ago when I would have made an ass of myself.
Okay, so I thought you and Danny and everybody already knew each other, and I was the only person that didn't. But I know Danny from the 80s, from the early 80s, from before he was road managing, like in Arizona, when my band, the Screaming Sirens, would pass through there, and we used to stay at the Dirt Clod's house, and at the Dirt Clod's house. It was the name of the band, but
oh, okay, the Dirt Clods.
Yeah, it was everyone would go there. It was like a big punk house in Arizona, and one day. We rolled up into Arizona, and we always stayed there. You know, there was always like fun people coming in and out. And the room that we normally slept in, we went to walk into it, like all trashed from driving somewhere in like Austin or something, you know. Right. And I could barely get the door open, and there was a gigantic dinosaur that had been stolen from the top of a gas station.
Oh yeah, I know those. The green brontosaurus. I know that.
Yeah, so I was sleeping under its back legs that night. Then also, Danny, at one point when he came to visit at Disgraceland, he brought me these three amazing clown suits his grandma had made for him as an offering of love.
How do you get blood out of a clown suit? That would be
awesome. Oh, I've asked myself that question several times.
I like at the dry cleaners. Like you're at the dry cleaners, and it's just like a clown suit, and just like in the wrapping paper. Sorry, we could not remove this stain.
It was just going on the to the wrong dry cleaner. You have to go to the one that Michael Myers goes to.
Yeah. What dry cleaner did John Wayne Gacy use, you know, back in the day?
Oh my God. Okay, so that aside from that diversion, I want to talk to you about one of our favorite ladies that we both know, but you know better than I do, because when I went to come and be on your podcast, a friend of mine was saying to me very enthusiastically, along the lines of dry cleaning and clown suits, this is like a this is like a macabre manicure thing. She's like, oh my God, if you're going to Dana's house, you've got to ask him to show you Vampira's fingernail. I heard he's got a real fingernail. Really, this was like, who this was the send-off I got first thing in the morning. My friend Morgan, she's the stage manager for my witchy burlesque show, Bill Book and Candle, but somehow she knew that about you. I don't know how, maybe she saw it on Instagram.
Yeah, it's partially true. I have a real fake fingernail.
I posted it on Instagram.
But I don't have one of Myla's fingernails. Like, I didn't pull a fingernail out of her hand. It's a beauty product.
I'm well aware of those.
But I wanted to, for the people listening, I wanted to clarify, I don't have parts of her body in my home.
He pulled out her fangs. Pulled out her fingernails.
Yeah, exactly. I have Walt Disney's toe.
Oh my God. You know, I have Spanky McFarlane's baby finger, but it's from the Hollywood Wax Museum.
Just as good.
That was a birthday present I got from someone who gave me a ventriloquist dummy called Willy Talk, and then
Willy Talk. Sure. No, I do. I do.
No, I'm sure you do. Do you have one?
I have I do have the Jimmy Nelson, How to Be a Ventriloquist LP that I had.
Read what I'm showing you.
Oh, the secrets of ventriloquism. So you're right with me.
I just happen to have it sitting on my desk.
Wow. Well, I have the How to Be a Ventriloquist LP that I had as a child. And
I'm going to force you to talk like a ventriloquist now.
Well, the bit that I had that I do, and I have the dummy in my garage, is it's a ventriloquist dummy, but the head is just an eyeball.
Oh, I think you posted a picture of that.
Yeah, he looks like he's in The Residence.
Yeah, I was just going to say that. Yeah.
Yeah, and the gag. And
how do you know he's not? Like, you keep him in the garage, you don't know what the fuck he's doing.
And the joke of the gag was that it was Hypno, the world's first hypnotizing ventriloquist dummy. So I would ask him a question, then he would look at me and put the answer into my head, and I would then give the answer. So there's actually no ventriloquism at all. So it'd be like, "How do you like school, Billy?" And then I would look at the dummy, "Closed." "He likes it closed." So it was pretty stupid.
I have this ventriloquist dummy that was given to me by an old boyfriend, and he didn't even know that I liked ventriloquist dummies, but obviously we had a soul connection.
Sure.
He came when we were barely first dating. So he drove down from Northern California, and he was holding, and I wasn't even expecting him. I opened the door and he was there. And he was holding his coat closed, and he opened it up, and he had a, there was this really cool vintage ventriloquist dummy that looked like a Jerry Mahoney one, and its head was all like cracked, but it had like blue eyeshadow on. I think this dummy's name was Willy Talk.
Sure, I remember Willy Talk.
I have it right over there.
If I'm not mistaken, Willie Talk was a ventriloquist dummy that you could buy over the counter, like a Sears at Sears, but he had, instead of the string in the back of his neck, he had the pole so you could turn his head. That was the...
Mine has a string.
Yeah.
But okay, so here's what happened. He was wearing a nice little suit that I immediately had to undress him. I don't know why. I mean, because I do have a lot of baby clown clothes and ventriloquist. Uh-huh. I liked his suit, but for some reason I undressed him. And on underneath of him,
Willie
like...
Cock.
Yeah. Willie Cock? Is that what you just said?
Yeah. Just wanted to make sure.
Willie Cock. Will he put out? No.
Yeah.
So, but well, this was actually right over his pelvis. It had a little boy's address. It said, oh, and first it said Holly Woodhead. Like that was the name in ballpoint pen that the kid had named him because he didn't want to call him Willie Talk. And then underneath it, it said, if found, please return to. And the kid put his address and there was no zip code. So I immediately Googled when did zip codes start, you know?
And yeah,
it was
right.
1963, so I know this was before 1963. But anyway, then I put his clothes. Yeah, so then I put his clothes back on, the dummy's clothes, and he was just sitting on top of the couch. And then my boyfriend and I went and had dinner. And then I forgot what else happened, except somehow we wound up getting quote amorous on the couch. And all of a sudden, I heard this huge like clattering, like that, and I was very in the moment, but I kind of just barely turned my head, and Willie Talk's mouth was right there, clattering up and down, and his jaw had come out of the mouth hole, and it was
it would be weird. So is this a supernatural event or just? It would be weird if you realize that his jaw unhinged and that even though he was a ventriloquist, I mean, he ate like a boa constrictor, like every month his jaw would unhinge. He'd eat a baby goat. Then he'd be good for a month.
That's probably what happened. That's probably where I got my power from.
That is astounding.
I know it was, I kind of thought at the moment, maybe I'm the only person this has ever happened to. I'm not sure, but it's either me or Paul Winchell.
Yeah. Well, you know, have we talked about Paul Winchell?
No, but let's please talk about him. Because
do you have his book, Winch?
No.
It's in my garage. I should run out and get it. His book, Winch, is, you know, is maybe the greatest show business autobiography ever.
I'm devastated that I didn't even know about it. Now I feel shame. I think that Hollywood had ate part of my brain.
Here's the deal. I tell you this now. I have to go out. When we're done, I have to go out and run a couple of errands. I'm going to hand deliver you Winch to read.
Because I'm going to give you Puppet Terror, magazine.
That's fine. We'll swap. And then we'll reconvene about Winch in a couple of weeks, and that'll be my next podcast.
Okay.
One of the things that Winch did, of the many things that he did.
The heart?
He built... Oh, yeah. Well, yeah, he's a self-taught surgeon. There's all that.
Wait, why didn't him and Hedy Lamarr get married?
That would have been great.
Yeah. Well,
because I don't know how much of Winch's is in Winch's. Winch was like Kanye, but a little unhinged.
How is that possible?
One of the things that Winch had in his house is Winch built a ventriloquist dummy in himself that he put in a room in his house that was dedicated specifically, so while he was out doing stuff, the ventriloquist dummy version of him could fight with the ghost of his mother.
Wow.
Boom.
Well, okay. Well, I had no idea we were going to start talking about supernatural dummies on this, but I'm so
I've gotten to the hard candy center.
No, you totally have. My friend,
I can't wait for you. Your mind is going to melt when you read this book.
Oh my God. Okay, yes, I will read it, and then we'll have to go on your podcast to discuss
to download Winch.
But I knew I also knew a ventriloquist dummy that didn't belong to me, but that dummy's name was Crack Pipe.
But please let it be like P-Y-P-E, like some sort of old world, the old English spelling of Crack Pipe.
P-Y-P-E. Like, oh my God. So the Wicker Man, speaking of old English and British Isles craziness, that the Wicker Man, that 70s pagan movie.
Sure, of course, yeah. With Christopher Lee, basically playing Hugh Hefner.
Yes, exactly. Or Jeffrey Epstein. Jeffrey Dahmer Epstein in this movie.
Like a creepy Jeffrey Epstein.
Yeah. They have the same hair now that you're talking about. Mm-hmm. But I just watched it last night, and there's a lot of like sick masks and puppet adjacent shit going on in that movie.
Yeah, the mask stuff in The Wicker Man is great. And that was remade terribly with Nicolas Cage. See the original one.
No, I saw the original one.
Yeah, that's the one you got to see. Yeah, it's great.
That's the one that's on it. It just went on Netflix.
There's this weird thing. I don't know when it ended, but even with myself, like I have a photo of myself as a kid. There was a time in this country when everyone wore turtlenecks.
I remember that. That was called the 70s.
Yeah. But like, what the fuck? Why?
I don't know. I mean, because I think
like every old Tonight Show, somebody's in a turtleneck with a necklace outside the turtleneck.
It had to be an ankh.
Yeah. They're not comfortable, but everyone.
No, they're not. I hate them.
And I have a photo of myself standing in front of my childhood house. I'm probably 7, sporting a Kelly green T-neck. And then in the 90s, we had the mock turtleneck, which is to the 90s what the Nehru suit is to the 60s.
Yeah, that's exactly. Mock turtlenecks. I used to think that I hated wearing them because I'd been hung in a previous life.
Yeah.
No, for real. I mean, seriously.
No one's arguing with you. Now, the podcast is called Devil Music. Is this specific? Do you get into music every episode, or is it more just that's how you describe your outlook on life and your predilections?
No, we talk about music, so we can talk about music. It's just anything music and the occult. And also now, you know, for the past few, well, since it started, it's just talking about weird shit.
Yeah, well, it is. This is a, you know, I was talking to somebody earlier today, and I was saying if there was any year that I would have liked to have relived, it would have been 1968. Although I lived in 1968, I was only 4. Because there was just so much going on in that year. And my friend used to go, look, if the world didn't end in 1968, it's not going to end now. But this is 2020 is 1968 again. It is as tumultuous a year as 1968 was. And I don't think in retrospect, I want to go back and relive it. But we are in this time where just like everything, as you know, the tablecloth has been yanked out and the dishes went on the floor. And we're just trying to ride the wave. Yeah, and we're just trying to ride the wave until it settles down.
I was trying to think of this, of 2020, like, you know, in relations to 1968 and 69, when I was busy getting thrown out of fourth grade for wearing a strike armband. I'm not kidding. I got sent home for wearing a strike armband on one arm and a war moratorium on the other arm. But But also, I can't tell how batshit this year is compared to then because I was a little kid.
Yeah, right. You were 10 years old.
Yeah, I was like 9. So the Merry Pranksters came to, I grew up on a college campus, and the Merry Pranksters came in a giant bus because the Grateful Dead was playing on the football field. This was at Wesleyan University. And that was my first concert. And there was someone on top of the, on the roof of the further bus of the Merry Pranksters. For anybody that's not aware of what this is, that's listening, the Merry Pranksters was pretty much what Ken Kesey's The Electric Kool-Aid Acid Test was about. And they were this band of lunatic, wonderful, revolutionary hippies that were very close to the Grateful Dead. And the acid tests that they did were actual real tests of Owsley's acid, which the recipes have now, some of them have appeared online, and some of them, as urban legend has it, were his reject recipes. Like, I think that's what bath salts was. Someone tried to make one of Owsley's reject.
Interesting.
Did you hear that? Because that seems completely credible.
That makes sense. Yeah, it makes sense. It tracks, as they say.
Yeah.
They were professional artists. You know, they were just they really believed in that ideal of that sort of Aquarian ideal. The Merry Pranksters and the Dead. When I lived in San Francisco, it was people and the Dead would come to town. I lived in San Francisco in the late 80s. And then when the Dead would come to town, it was people doing an impression of the Merry Pranksters.
Right. The parking, the whole parking lot was in because in the 70s, me and a bunch of other people in the LA punk scene would always, we'd look at the, it's the magic text twinkle Disney noise. So we would watch the papers and see if the Grateful Dead were coming to LA just so we could go, you know, to the parking lot and buy acid because the Deadheads always had the best acid. We'd show up there in like black leather jackets and just our normal punk, you know, punk attire. Nobody batted an eyelash, but they would.
It's
just
so funny because the whole punk sort of ethos, to use a 50 Cent word, was such a rejection of hippie culture, but the drugs made it through.
Yeah, the drugs made it through. I mean, it was punk. Punk was also, you know, it was a rejection of rock and roll culture at that time, but
it was, it was more a rejection of the ELO. It was corporate millionaire. It was like a limousine millionaire rock stars that were
even ELO in retrospect was better than like Captain and Tennille, although I find like
Joy, this is over, this conversation is over.
No, come on, Muskrat Love, how the fuck do you get like a hit with like Alvin and the Chipmunks making like nature documentary noises, and it's that supposed to be normal?
That is that is one of those things. I'm gonna put that in my shoebox with Hogan's Heroes. Like,
I have a Hogan's Heroes story for you. Oh, fuck.
Like, how does that happen? What's the song about? It's a love song. What's it about? Do you know what a muskrat is?
Okay,
I'm listening.
Okay, so this was like decades before I knew about Bob Crane's like quote alleged S&M activities. But,
oh yeah, he was a dirty bird.
Yeah, well, I mean, like he was hot, you know.
Sure.
Hogan was having like Joy Division off camera.
Yeah, exactly.
But so I
Bob Crane's Hogan was his hero.
Yeah. God. Wait, maybe he called his dick Little Hogan.
Yeah, or it's more like like Colonel Hogan's crane is always bobbing is another way to go.
Okay, so
I've never unpacked that.
Well, now you did, and you're packing.
Exactly.
Okay, so I I wound up going to boarding school when I was 14 because I was having sex with all my mom's theater students, and I was really intelligent, and they were starting to have, like, you know, like less privileged people. They wanted to give scholarships. You know what I mean? Right. So I got one. So my mom thought it'd be a good idea to get me off a college campus, not realizing that I was going right into a rurally located campus that was a hotbed of people whose private helicopters were landing on the football field and their Gucci luggage that had been their grandmother's in the 1940s, because they weren't ostentatious in that way, had older brothers and sisters who got the best drugs on earth. So that was that was the hotbed. I started seeing this guy. Actually, I stole him from my girlfriend, but, you know, hashtag story of my life. his father was an ambassador. I'm not even going to say to what country, even though the statute of limitation is gone, but he was so cute. He had blonde dirty.
Oh, you froze. What I see.
Just taken over my one-track mind. Believe it or not, you're in my heart all the time. All the girls are saying that you'll end up a fool. For the time being, baby, live by my rules. When I settle down, I want one.
We just had a power blackout right in the middle of our episode, and we were talking about Hogan's Heroes.
Yeah.
Okay, so the Hogan's Heroes. Okay, this is so Pavlovian. I was seeing this really cute boy from boarding school, and we used to sneak into the theater in the boarding school. And this was—it was such an old school. It was like an old New England school. And of course, this was my idea because I noticed that for the school play, there was a big brass bed on stage. And so then my thought was, if you could pull the curtain, then you're not going to get caught in your dorm room because no one ever uses the theater in the daytime. So the theater was just unlocked. So we met in there and we used to make out in there. And that was getting to be such a regular thing that when the play, like, changed over to a new play, there was no longer a bed on stage. So we crawled up into near where the lighting booth was, and we were making out all over the floor there, you know, instead of the seats, because it was easier to stretch out on the floor than in the theater seats. And then one day we heard the theme to Hogan's Heroes playing, and it got louder and louder, and then we heard a door open, and so we, like, rolled against the wall and we're acting like people in a horror movie, because who the hell was opening up a door? And it turned out to be the chaplain of the school, and he walked out, and it was time to go to dinner anyway. Like, the dinner bell had rang for, like, the big cafeteria that everybody went to. And so we just stayed there and then separately went on our ways to dinner. But then we found out that the chaplain actually lived in an apartment above the theater. So then we started, because this just added an extra layer of perversion, we started just going up there on purpose to make out. And whenever we heard Hogan's Heroes theme song, we'd know that he was going to get ready to leave to go to dinner in a few minutes. So we would scurry out of there. So flash forward to, like, 30 years or more later, I can't even remember where I was. I was like somewhere in a public, you know, like somewhere in public with a bunch of people around me. And the theme to Hogan's Heroes came on, and I was like, oh, I love this song. And everyone turned at me and they're like, what? And I was like, I love the song. And they're like, why? And I was like, I don't know why. And they're like, this isn't even a song. It's a television theme song. And there's better ones, like the Munsters theme. And then all of a sudden it clicked in my head that it was like a Pavlovian response to teenage sex. It was like some CIA operative just turning on the trigger of, like, all that, like, 13 and 14 year old lust, you know?
Sure, exactly. Yeah. My friend. It is one of those things where you don't know like when you see it now, it's on MeTV now, and you do go, what were we thinking?
Yeah, how the fuck did that get green lighted?
Yeah. Or like when you watch Roller Boogie, it's like, what were we thinking? but Hogan's Heroes specifically, because what's interesting about Hogan's Heroes is nowadays you'd be horrified. It's a comedy that takes place in a Nazi prison camp. People would go, You need to go to jail. However, the people that made Hogan's Heroes were much closer to World War II than we are.
Totally.
It's like a lot of the people, and maybe that's why they could do it, because they were so close to it, they didn't care about it. It's like, whatever.
People I knew, like kids that I knew, even before that, like when I was really little, their dads would have those German helmets with spikes on top of it, like on the mantelpiece.
That they brought back.
Yeah.
So weird. And there's a proximity. Like I think because they were so close to World War II, they were able to make fun of it. Whereas now we're farther away from it, we can appreciate the horror more.
Oh yeah. I mean, and what about like I find it interesting that you're saying this, because there's a couple of punk rock connections to World War II in a really odd way that I think it must have come from their parents, because all of those people were like kind of the same age as me or you or between us, or because I don't even know how old you are. But
I'm 55.
Like when, what?
I'm 55.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I'm 61. So we're in that same-ish.
Yeah.
I'm cougaring on you. Yes, that's true. The last part. But like Orchestral Maneuvers in the Dark did that song Enola Gay about the atomic bomb.
Right.
And then what about even the name of Joy Division?
Sure,
you know?
Sure, yeah. Totally.
Yeah. And then that, like, because And even in those days, and still in London, there's like whole
Berlin
whole parts
airlift.
Of the East End that are there's whole parts of European cities that are just still bombed out from World War II, which is like insane. Yeah.
Well, that's so funny. Like when people go to Berlin and they expect to see this ancient city, it's like, no, this city was built in 1947. Everything here was built in 1950 because it was leveled.
We built this city. Oh, I'm God, sorry. Please.
But yeah, it's all the architecture in Berlin now is this very functional mid-century. Just get a building up, put a box, make it a box.
Same with Dresden. Like, there's some parts of, and yeah, all that weird stuff. The first time that I went to Europe.
It's all gone.
The first time I went to Europe, I landed in the airport I can't even remember what airport, but the main international airport is, but the train station was under the airport, and I got on it, and it was a subway for a long time until it started coming out into the light, and it blew a whistle because it was coming out at the end of the tunnel, and it sounded just like the whistle on all those concentration camp movies.
Yep.
war movies from World War II. Yeah. And I was like, yeah, as soon as we came out into the tunnel and it was color, because it was normal, it was summertime in Germany, I was like, wait, because I think I thought it was going to be black and white.
Black and like, white.
Seriously.
Of course.
It was so weird.
Oh my God, that's really, and that's true, it's like there's a distance to it. I was always fascinated by, like everybody makes like Charles Manson jokes and Charles Manson references.
Yeah.
But then like you'd see people in like a Charles Manson t-shirt, but you don't want to go, he wasn't cool. it's like he's not somebody you should look up to in any way.
But were you obsessed with Charles Manson?
Of course. Yes, yeah, okay. Of course. No, I have every book. I wouldn't wear, and I have bits about Charles Manson on every album I have, you know.
Oh my God.
I probably have an hour's worth of Charles Manson material. I find him fascinating in the way that I find Richard Nixon fascinating. Like, you know, these incredibly damaged people that are able to achieve a level of power.
Jim Jones.
Yeah, of course.
Jim Jones came from Indiana too. So did John Dillinger. Indiana was a hotbed of...
The Midwest is... My girlfriend's from Omaha, Nebraska. Don't get me started on the Midwest.
Oh no, that place is insane too.
Yeah. But I was always very specific about, like, he's not cool. Like, I was at a horror convention, like Fangoria, FangoCon or something like that, you know.
Yeah.
And there's people selling monster movie memorabilia. And there's one guy, and it was sort of like, you remember Mondo Video in Vermont?
Of course.
Yeah.
The best part about Mondo Video was they had a section of videos, and it was called Pedophiles, and the only two DVDs or VHSs that were in there was a Mr. Rogers one, and then Kindergarten Cop.
Well, that's funny, but there was sort of like that sort of like Gigi Allen.
Oh yeah, yeah.
Devotees. It was a guy that had a booth like that, and he was selling Manson color, Manson crime scene photos.
Wow.
Yeah. And I was like, I don't want this. Like, it's, no. I don't want the, it's like, there's nothing about this that's cool. This is bad. It was like the Museum of Death. It was the Museum of Death people. It's like, yeah, I don't need this. I'm fascinated by him. I don't think he's not a hero of mine.
Yeah.
You know, I always understood that like a Manson t-shirt was for shock value, and that I got. And I would have certainly worn like a Manson t-shirt, like if he had like a beanie hat on or something on the shirt, like something goofy. But seriously thinking he was cool, I was always like, no, that's, you missed it. You missed the point. You took the wrong exit.
Yeah, there's just, I always just was into the whole crazy cult leader thing.
It's fascinating. What I did not know was, if you've ever seen the film Satan's Sadists, which I saw a long time ago.
With
Russ Tamblyn?
Yeah.
They filmed part of that at the Spann Ranch.
Really?
After the murders.
Wow!
Before the arrests.
Shit! So
they were still there. They didn't know who had done it yet.
Oh my God, that's crazy.
And Manson was kind of hanging around the set, ogling the actresses, and the director, this guy Al Adamson, said to the stuntman, found a burly stuntman, is like, will you get that guy out of here, please? And had to go walk up to this little shrimpy 5'4" guy. Hey, can you get out of here? We're trying to work. And it was Charles Manson.
Oh my God.
He left no problem. He didn't give anybody any problem.
Wow.
I know. It was crazy. It was crazy. Crazy.
Crazy. Want to know the weirdest weirdest tarot reading that I ever did? Started the night before the reading was booked with a complete stranger. Uh-huh. I was having a regular text thread with the girl that co-produces Bell Book and Candle, my burlesque show, with me.
Sure.
And it was like 2:30 in the morning, and I said, okay, apropos of nothing, here's a picture of Bobby Beausoleil. Good night. And I just sent her a hot picture of Bobby Beausoleil. And the next morning at like 9:30, I had a reading with this person that I'd never read before, who found me on Twitter. And I laid out her cards, and I was telling her that she was in a, you know, some kind of a wild relationship with a guy that seemed like his emotional development was stunted in late adolescence, and they were very close, but it was really separated and all this stuff. And then she was telling me that she was like, yep, that's right on, that's right on. And then she said that she was talking to someone in prison, and it was like handling affairs for them. And then I just blurted out, was it Bobby Beausoleil? And she and I heard her gasp, and she's like, how do you know this? And I was like, and I never do this with clients. I just took a screenshot of the text thread and sent it to her.
Wow. But I clearly, like to me, that's like a time fold. Like,
yeah.
Bobby Beausoleil was in there, but you thought about it, you know, it's like, if you came in there, it came in there the next morning, but then somehow it was the night before, and that's when it started. Like it was,
yeah, that's what it. That was insanity.
Yeah, that's crazy. I thought so. He's still in. Is he still around?
Yes, he is.
Yeah, those people don't. The bit that I would do is that Charles Manson is still up for parole every 2 or 3 years. And I'm like, does he get his hopes up? like, is he in jail the night before practice? Hi, Charles Manson. Nice to see you. How are you, Charles Manson? How are you? Nice to see you, Charles. How are you? Thinking about the job he's going to get when he's out. Charles Manson, Emerson Drywall. Come on in.
Yeah, Charles Manson, essential worker.
I used to run a murder cult, but I've taken that passion and put it into hot tub installation.
Or working at Vaughn's.
Yeah, no, it's no, that's the, I mean, the true crime stuff is utterly utterly fascinating to anyone.
Yeah. I mean, maybe not to a lot of people, but if you're my kind of person, like apparently you are. Okay, so let's talk about vampire stuff more. So you had a very close relationship with her.
I got a woman, she's 6'3". Got loving and mighty strange. Vampire, that's her name. Vampire, yeah, vampire. Vampire, yeah, that's my baby's name. Late last night, we were out all alone.
Yes, I did.
How did it start?
Well, I, you know, was always a plan, you know, I always loved that stuff, Plan 9 and the 50s, 60s LA and, you know, all that stuff. And, I did a show on the Sci-Fi Channel in 1994 called The Big Scary Movie Show. And I was hosting horror movies, which is,
I remember that. Yeah.
That was always the only job I felt I was qualified to do. And I wanted to interview her. I thought, like, you can't host a horror movie without, you have to touch the Parthenon, you know, you've got to honor the original. And my very good friend, Carol Hernandez, who is the wife of Gilbert Hernandez of the Love and Rockets, the cartoon.
Love and Rockets.
Right. She worked at Hollywood Book and Poster, and she was like, oh, I know Mila.
Eric.
Yes, Eric. God rest his soul. So I wrote a letter. I wrote like a letter. I was like, hi, I'm friends Carol. Didn't you know, I'd love to interview you, pay with blah, 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 blah. And it all came together. And so I interviewed her for the show. And that's on YouTube. If you go on YouTube, like Danny Gould Vampire, you can see that.
Oh, yeah. We'll put the link to that.
I'm a little boy in it. It's 1995 and I'm a little boy. And then she didn't have a phone. But I really, you know, it was like meeting, you know, anybody that you click with. And even though she was, you know, older than my mother, we just really like kind of clicked. And so we became pen pals, and you know, I'd write her a letter, and like once a week,
Yeah,
just because I lived on Beechwood. I lived like four blocks up from where you are now, and she was down at the time off Melrose, off Hudson.
Yeah,
and so we would just write letters, and then I was like, "Hey, let's go to lunch," and then I would take her to lunch at Musso and Frank's. And over the years, the people that she had as a support system, because she never had any kids, got divorced in 54, kind of fell away. And I sort of became, for lack of a better term, her ambassador to reality. and ended up, you know, I got her moved into a and then fortunately, then I started, you know, I got married and I started working at The Simpsons, and I had means. And I got her into a better place to live. I got her a phone in case she had an emergency. And, you know, and then, you know, and we would just talk on the phone, and I would, you know, we'd go out to lunch to Musso and Frank's. And if she had a problem, I would fix it. That was it. You know, it was just like, it was funny because she absolutely stopped becoming Vampira to me and just became Mila. You know,
Mila,
so, yeah. Oh shit, I gotta call Mila. Oh shit, I have to call Mila. But one of my favorite memories was I took her to see the Cinerama Dome back when it was just the dome, yeah, before the Arc Light was showing Plan 9 on Halloween night at midnight or something. So I said, we should go. So I took her, and we're just sitting in there. No one knows it's her.
Of course, she's not.
Yeah. And she comes on screen and the place goes bananas. And so to sit next to her, and she, you know, she like, you could feel her absorb it, you know, because knowing that was all to her.
That's amazing. And
just, yeah. And just, and what she said was so funny. She went, oh, there she is.
Ah.
You know,
yeah,
it was great because the place was packed and the place went nuts, and I could feel her absorb it, you know, for
wow,
sure.
That's really incredible.
Yeah. And she was just, I mean, my favorite thing about her was she was just really funny. She was really,
hilarious.
Yeah,
I didn't know her as well as you, but I knew her for a pretty long time on and off because Tomato from the Screamers made me start going to this coffee shop in Hollywood. And
Tomato DuPlenty?
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. And she talked about him a lot.
Yeah. They were really good friends.
They
and
were
Tomato
very good friends, yeah.
Like, oh, Vampira goes there all the time. Like you should go and see her. And I was going there sometimes anyway, because it was in the neighborhood where I was living, you know. And I was sitting at the counter one day, and there was this lady next to me, and we started talking, and so it went on for ages. I would see her, and then finally one day I was just like,
"Did this lady not have upper teeth?"
What?
No. No,
you know what? Like, there was a lot of women like that around Hollywood then that you could tell by their cheekbones and their eyes and stuff that they had been starlets like me. And my friends would say that person was a starlet, no matter what. Either they dressed like still like how they had in the 40s or the 50s, yeah, and were on the bus, or you could just tell by their bone structure that they weren't just a normal person in Hollywood. They'd once been somehow like a contract player or famous in some way, like in a lower strata Hollywood level. So I knew that this lady was probably that kind of a person. And then finally I was like, you know, my name is Pleasant. Like, we've been talking for ages and I don't know your name. And she said, oh, hi, I'm Mila, like that. And then I went, hi. And then all of a sudden it clicked in my head, and I was trying to act normal.
Uh-huh. Yeah, 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 yeah.
Like,
yeah.
What? I've been talking to Vampira for months and I have no idea.
Yeah. But that was her. She was very, I think one of the reasons that she became adopted by sort of as a punk icon was because she was a punk. She was just a punk in 1954.
Yeah.
You know, but she had the same sort of, she didn't suffer fools well.
No. But she was also so funny and like seemed like just very kind and normal person
great.
Too.
But know? Also, we used to have I used to have a place in Ojai. Now my ex-wife has a place in Ojai, and that makes it sound worse than it is. But actually quite not. It's quite good. Long story longer. So spent a lot of time up in Ojai, and there was a woman up there named Beatrice something, and she was like the doyen of the Ojai art community. She was a ceramic artist, and apparently the house up there that I owned had her ceramics in the front walk or some weird thing that I had no knowledge of. And then I read a little bit about her because somebody pointed it out, and she was a big part of the beatnik scene in LA. So then I'm talking to Milo later, and I go, whatever this woman's name is, Susie Jones, not it, but I'm like, hey, when you were back in the day, did you ever know Susie Jones? And Smiley just went, ugh, a tiresome potter.
Beatrix Potter.
I know. Tiresome. But her whole kind of was like, tiresome. Just tiresome. So great. Fucking great. Yeah, she was a hoot. She was a good lady.
She was a good lady. Great.
Yeah. She gave me the story of the fingernail is quite interesting. December of 2007, I'm driving to the airport with my wife and my two kids, and we're going to back east for the holidays. And so I called her up literally on the way to the airport, like, hey, I'm going to the airport. I'll be back after Christmas. We have your gifts. If you need anything until then, call me here and I'll get whatever, you know, like I had people set up, like if you need help, I'll take care of it. Even if I'm not in town. So she's like, great, 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 great. And then hung up. And, I said to my wife, I said, like, you know, cause she, by this time, excuse me, by this time she was getting on, and I'm like, what are we going to do when she needs to go to a place to live, when she can't live alone anymore? And my wife said, well, we'll just find a place. I'm like, no, I'm not worried about the place. I'm worried about her. She's not going to go. You know, she's going to handcuff herself. She did not want that. And then we got home, and unfortunately she passed away before I got a chance to get over there. So that was the last time that I spoke with her. So I go down to, I'm on the lease. So they call me and I have to go down there and do all the, you know, identification stuff, which is not cool. And there was I knew her little bungalow. I knew every inch of it. And there was a little like jewelry box on the TV, which is that you've seen the little beige thing. And I was like, what the hell is this? And I opened it up and it was my Christmas gift. It was for Dana, and it was her artificial nail that she had done a self-portrait on. But that's how I got it. I literally was just standing in after she had been taken out. And then I noticed this thing that I hadn't seen before. So that was also, it seemed somewhat spooky.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. But, you know, she doesn't haunt me. Wherever she is, she's very happy.
Yeah. It seems like she would be. And I have to tell you that I was at Hollywood Cemetery the other day, and I just posted a picture of the lake.
Yes.
On Instagram, but every comment on there was, well, every other comment, and there was a lot of comments, was from people saying vampire is my favorite grave there.
I have to say something about that grave. I'm glad people like it. I picked that out. I thought it was really funny that she's right in front of Darren McGavin, who was the Night Stalker. I like the fact that he's chasing a vampire throughout eternity. I really wish she had a bigger, better stone. But by that time, her family had stepped in, that she didn't have any relation with. They showed up and I had to step back. And they out of the goodness of their heart, bought the cheapest possible stone. And that's what she has. Part of her would probably have done the same thing, because she didn't put a lot of weight on that kind of stuff. But I wish she had something a little bit more significant.
Yeah, she should have a statue like Johnny Ramone's.
Well, I was talking to Tom Kuntz about who designed that, who sculpted that thing that's in my that I showed you.
Yeah.
About doing something, it just didn't come together in time, and you know, you have to respect the family legally, even if they didn't really have any relationship.
No, I get that. Yeah, but she definitely is living on in everyone's consciousness, like with or without anything.
Yeah, there's a really great documentary about her that a guy named Ray Green made called Vampira and Me, which is really great. And Johnny Coffin has her merchandising rights and has done a really, really wonderful job of keeping her out in the public and out in awareness. He has a book coming out.
Oh, he does? That's great.
Yeah, it's mostly photos and just like he has like I wrote a little epilogue for it and it's just pictures and stuff that I didn't, you know, I thought I had everything. I had nothing. And that's coming out at, you know, COVID kind of slowed everything up. But yeah, there's a group of people that really have worked very hard and they keep her out there. And that's very satisfying. It's very, to see that, whatever it was that she created really does have appeal, a lasting appeal.
Oh yeah. Yeah. It's like, it's like the Mount Olympus of dark beauty.
Yeah, perfect. Yeah, and she kind of created that look. She sort of
completely
combined Morticia Adams and Marilyn Monroe and came up with that.
Yeah, which is the best thing ever.
Which is hardly how I describe myself to people.
I think of you that way too, Dana. but you're holding a ventriloquist dummy on your lap.
As well I should be.
Okay, I think this is a good point to end it, but we need to do this again on both of our podcasts.
We will. Well, here's the deal. Are you home all day or are you going out?
Yeah, you're bringing me ventriloquist dummy shit,
I've
right?
I've got stuff to do here, but I'm going to text you. I'm going to be in your hood. I'll have a mask. We'll socially distance. But
all right, I'm gonna get some puppet stuff for you, and I'll put a mask on my ventriloquist dummy. Okay.
But I've got to give you. Yeah, I have to give you a book to read.
Okay.
All right. So I'll see you shortly.
Mwah.
Bye. Until then.
Bye.
Bye.
Well, that was Dana Gould. How fucking amazing is he? I was going to try to throw my voice to say this, but it didn't work out. Anyhow, you can find Dana all over the internet, and all of his socials are really easy because it's his name. His website is danagould.com. That's D-A-N-A. GOULD.com. His Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook are at Dana Gould. And his Patreon is patreon.com/Dana Gould. So you can get him anywhere. You can throw money on him at Patreon, and hopefully he'll get up some funds for buying more ventriloquist dummies. And if you want to find me, you can find me at pleasantgaiman.com. PLEASANTGEHM as in man, AN as in Nancy.com. You can get tarot readings from me there. You can buy my book, Showgirl Confidential, or you can just stalk me via email. See you next time on The Devil's Music. Mwah!
The Devil's Music is written and hosted by Pleasant Gaiman. Produced by Aaron Alden. All sound design by Jerry Danielson of Busy Signal Studios. And of course, is part of the Pantheon Podcast Network. Find all of our shows at pantheonpodcasts.com. Our social presence is at Pantheon Podcasts on Facebook and Instagram. Tweet us at Pantheon Pods. All songs can be found wherever you get great music. Please pick up these important and fantastic tracks.
Hey, this is Liberty DeVito.
This is Mike Del Judas.
This is Michael Cavanaugh from Broadway's Moving Out.
This is John Jackson, director of the Billy Joel Archive.
This is Russell Javers.
This is Richie Cannata, and you're listening to Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast. It's awesome.
I'm Michael Grosvenor.
And I'm Jack Fernino.
We're lifelong Billy Joel fans who launched a podcast in 2020 celebrating the music we love.
Whether you're looking for the greatest hits or the B-sides and rarities, you'll find it all here. And if you've ever wondered what happens behind the scenes of a concert or recording session, we've got you covered.
Join us as we explore albums, tours, band members, the latest news, and more. You'll also get a unique glimpse into the music industry straight from the musicians and other professionals who help make it all happen.
Tune into Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast, at glasshousespod.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast, is a proud member of the Pantheon Podcasts Network.